Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm all right, thank you, John.
Excellent. Been a bit grumpy today.
A bit.
Tom Dyens, how are you doing, Tom?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Excellent. We're going to talk about Interserve, which is, yes. We've had lots of communication on Interserve, both through the website and emails to me. Some of the concerns that have been expressed in those communications are addressed in your piece, so we'll talk about that. Let's start, Phil, with your main column this week, which is about pubs, a subject dear to our hearts, and specifically JD Weatherspoon.
Yeah.
So, the pub sector has been a horrible sector to both invest in, to operate in. It's what we hear all these stories of, you know, pubs closing every week. JD's Weatherspoon has been the kind of shining star in this sector. And the question you're asking is, can it continue?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the pub sector as a whole, it's been it's like a bomb site. I think there are only three companies that have really made decent money for investors over the long haul. That is Fuller's. And you've got Young's, which are essentially London-based outfits, where going to the pub, going out, very much part and parcel of the way of life. And the other one is JD Weatherspoon, which operates a very distinct and different way of doing business, in that it is very much a value operator, has a very simple business model, cheap food, cheap drinks in pubs that are kept in good condition.
Yeah, now, you and I occasionally go to the pub for a quick conflab, putting the world to rights.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know one of your biggest gripes when we go for a pint in London is the price.
Yeah.
And it is quite eye-watering sometimes. We're talking £6 a pint in some pubs.
Mitchells and Butlers, yeah.
Yeah, we do go to an MAB pub. Yeah. £6 a pint, put prices down. That's never going to happen. JD Weatherspoon, value proposition, and like in many sectors, retail, for example, value has been the successful model.
I am, in a general investing theme, I am a big fan of businesses that can communicate value to their customers. This is a winning theme in most sectors. But probably not in pubs.
Yeah, but it has been a winning theme for Weatherspoon.
I'll qualify that from now on.
From now on, okay. So
it has been very successful for Weatherspoons, and it's caused Weatherspoons to be a very divisive company amongst customers and rival pub operators to boot.
Yeah, I guess there's something you allude to in the piece that you've written, which is the kind of snob factor, which means that people like me will cough up £6 a pint in a borough market, and other people and perhaps not want to go to Weatherspoons. I can see Dom nodding over the control room.
Yeah, I think there's terrible snobbishness about Weatherspoons.
Yeah,
and you know, you've got to park your opinions about the owner as well. You know, who talks about other things from time to time.
It's from time to time.
From time to time.
Does he ever talk about anything else?
And then look at, you know, actually look at what this company does. And, you know, there's a lot of people who will disagree with you and Dom. This has come through in the numbers, that this is a company that has a very effective way of doing business and is very good at getting people to buy more food and drink from its pubs.
I guess the big question is, how has it been able to offer such cheap prices over the years when other pubs seemingly look for every opportunity to add another 5, 10, 10, 10p to their pints?
I think it's deliberately gone for a volume strategy. So it has, if you look at its margins, you know, its margins are, what, they're down to about 7 pence in the pound now, 7%. Some of the bars will operate. I know Mitchells and Butlers is operating on sort of low double digit margin, which is a valid comparator because they don't have a brewing operation as well.
Neither do Fuller's now.
No,
I mean, this is a trend. We could perhaps come on to this.
This is a trend.
The pub group selling off their brewing arms.
It's going for volume, and it's essentially about keeping the pubs busy. So they were the first major pub chain to open the doors at 7 a.m. in the morning for breakfast and for coffees, and it's about sweating those pub assets and getting lots of people through the doors.
They're pretty sharp on cost control as well.
Yeah. There's a whole sort of ethos about looking for those marginal gains in cost. And thankfully for them is that they have been able to get the top line and get the sales going as well. And this is what's kept them out of trouble. One of the main reasons why the likes of Mitchells and Butlers and Revolution Bars at the bottom end of the scale have got into trouble is that we've got a lot of cost inflation, particularly wages in this sector, and those operators have not been really growing their sales, and hence their profits have been under big pressure. Wetherspoons, up until last week, has been able to offset that, but it seems that the costs are really beginning to bite with this company now.
Is it that they've reached the point where, because they've been so efficient in terms of managing their costs, there's nowhere else to go? And actually the only cost pressures are to the upside because of things like wage inflation.
I don't think they've got as far as they can get. I think waging, it's a very labour intensive sector. You know, wages are getting close to, you know, a third of revenues. And when you look at an economy that has very high levels of employment, to get people to come and work in pubs, you just have to pay them more.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Martin, as we alluded to, you know, he's a big fan of Brexit. Brexit, you know, has one of the big concerns that certain businesses have is that the supply of cheaper labour will dry up. There is a paradox here, isn't there? There's a bit of cognitive dissonance, perhaps.
Maybe. I don't want to go there.
No. We saw some figures, though. I mean, their workforce is, I think, front of house is largely UK-based staff. I think it was kitchen staff that were largely overseas employees.
And that's probably a sector issue
rather
than just a Wetherspoon-specific issue. It's not just wages. It's things like business rates. One of the things I talk about a lot in the piece is maintenance and replacement investment of the pubs. This is a big problem for the whole sector, and Mitchells and Butlers have talked about this extensively, in that if you want people to come into your pubs, you've got to keep them looking nice.
Mm.
And this generates your turnover. The problem is that you spend money on these pubs and 5 or 6 years later, you have to do it all over again just to keep people coming through the doors. And this has been a big change over the last probably 5 years, where probably you would have asked somebody this question not so long ago and they would have said, well, we can do them up every 10 years.
I guess people like Wetherspoon would prefer that all their customers were like journalists who prefer the worst pubs in the world. But there you go. There's a figure you mentioned here based on the spending on repairs and maintenance, which is that figure has doubled.
Yeah.
In recent years.
This is the repairs and maintenance. So this is not replacing furniture, ovens and that kind of thing. This is just repairs and maintenance.
Like broken tiles, blocked toilets.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, if you go back and look at Wetherspoons over the long term, which I've done, this was running at about 2% of sales 20 years ago. It's now 4 and a bit. And this is eating into margin. And you put this and then you put the replacement, the refurbishment spend that the companies are under big pressure to do, otherwise people go elsewhere. And this is putting a big pressure on profit margins and cash flow.
Is this prompting a change in strategy at Wetherspoons? Because one of the things you mentioned is that it feels that there are certain sites that it's perhaps overinvested in.
Yeah.
It's cutting the estate rather than expanding.
Yeah,
it now.
I mean, I think the pub numbers peaked a few years ago at about 950, and we're about 880 now, something that kind of level. And it seems to me that Tim Martin, in particular, has put his hands up and said, we're probably not going to open that many more pubs. And so the size of the pub estate is not really going to grow that much. I think what will happen and what has been happening is that they will juggle their portfolio of pubs around and replace poorly performing ones with better performing ones in the same area. But generally, I think that there's a few signs here for me that the days of Wetherspoons expanding is coming to an end.
Yeah, I mean, something we spoke about before we came into the room was that you can see this business being run in a very different way, potentially as a cash generator.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that gives this away is that the company over the last few years has regularly referred to having a debt level to profits or EBITDA, which is not quite profits, but you know, there or thereabouts, of between 0 and 2 times over the long haul. And it's currently running at 3.5 times. And given that profits are unlikely to grow that much, in my opinion, the only way you can get that ratio of debt to profit down is by running the business for cash and using the cash flows. And Wetherspoons is very good at generating cash, using those cash to pay down debt.
The share price has done really well.
It's been great.
Do you think this is a response to actually people are looking at this kind of shifting strategy and going, actually, we like that. This is the time for this company to do what it's doing.
I think this company has done a lot of things right over the years. And
one of the things that actually jumped out when I read the piece was the conversion of its pubs from leasehold to freehold. Yeah, that seems like a very sensible move, margin of safety.
Definitely. I think what's happening here is the quality of the pub estate and the profits and the cash flows that come from it is getting higher. And what we've had is over the last decade, you mentioned the freehold thing, this has moved from 40% leasehold, 40-60 leasehold freehold to 60-40 freehold leasehold. And this is great for pubs because you get asset backing and you get flexibility to manage your estate. If you look at elsewhere in the sector, which is, you know, Revolution Bars, which has been an absolute dog of a company, they are running 100% leasehold. And they've signed up to very long leases and the trading has gone down and they can't get out of them and there's no asset backing. And you know, this is not a sector to get into if you've got no asset backing. And Wetherspoons has spent a lot of money the last few years, a lot of its surplus cash flow to buy out the freeholds. Now whether it will keep on doing that, I don't know, whether he feels that 60-40 is the right mix or he'll do more. I think if he wants to get debt down, he can't do any more of this.
I mean, you're kind of alluding in this piece to the fact that this is an ex-growth business.
Yeah. I think it is.
Does that mean, and as it's run for cash, if that is the strategy, does that mean that it becomes a dividend payer instead?
I think no. I think it becomes a almost like a leveraged buyout type business where the equity of the business builds through retirement of debt, which is to me, is a very smart strategy.
Is it worth holding on to the shares for that aspect of the strategy alone, potentially?
I think that, you know, if you ask me, do I think this company is going to keep doing better than most of the sector, I would probably think yes.
Yeah, but it's a difficult sector.
It's a difficult sector. This is arguably the best operator in the sector, but it's just so tough out there now.
Mm. And it doesn't have a brewing business to sell. So there you go. Interesting, an interesting view on how you might analyse companies in the sense of that. I think it's absolutely fascinating. Another difficult sector, thank you, Phil. Another difficult sector is obviously outsourcing, which you, Tom, have had the pleasure of watching the downfall of this sector over the past few years. And we've had another company go to the wall this week, Interserve.
Yes, so they entered administration last Friday. Curiously enough, they announced they'd won some new contracts on Monday.
It's a strange administration, this one, because it's not like Carillion. It's not like the thing has literally vaporised.
Yeah.
It's being managed in a slightly different way. Talk through exactly how this works. And as I said earlier, there have been some questions from our readers about why this has been allowed to happen, because it's wiped out shareholders.
Absolutely.
Obviously. Yeah. And shareholders can't understand why. And you might have some explanations for them here. Very smelly, one of them described it as, and it does smell a little bit.
It absolutely stinks, yeah. So the key difference between Carillion and Interserve is that Carillion entered liquidation, so the contracts were sold off on an individual or kind of group, sold off in packages, or just sort of ran off. Pre-pack administration, which is what Interserve did, basically meant that Interserve PLC went into administration. All of the companies below it just traded into the ownership of a new company, also called Interserve, which owned by the lenders.
Okay.
So they say business as usual. Suppliers shouldn't panic, employees shouldn't panic, this sort of thing.
There is a comment from a supplier, actually, on the site, someone who's done a lot of work for Interserve. And they have had some reassurances, but no cash as yet.
I think the cash is king here. It's, for all that they say not to panic at the moment, it didn't go into administration for no reason. So to imagine it can just continue on as it has been going on seems, in my mind, a little naive. I think there will be changes, and there's been some fairly strong rumours, though neither of the companies would comment publicly, that Mighty and Serco have been sniffing around to pick up some of the parts of the business. I would expect we'll see a bit of that, parts of Interserve being packaged up and sold off.
Yeah, well, I guess these contracts need to carry on. Someone needs to do the work, so that makes sense. I guess the big question is a rescue package was essentially put to shareholders, and some of those shareholders appear to have voted down this rescue package.
Yeah,
and that's meant that they've essentially ended up with zero.
Yeah,
and this is the main question our readers ask: is why?
Yeah, and that is there's. No hard answers here, unfortunately. There's a few different theories. Coltrane Asset Management, a US hedge fund, is the main culprit here. They owned about 28% of the shares at the time that the group went into administration. They also voted against the deal. Now, they had been opposing it since it was announced. As soon as the details were announced, they tried to requisition a general meeting to fire all of the directors with the exception of the CEO. And they succeeded in getting the deleveraging plan sweetened a bit. Originally, existing shareholders would have ended up with 2.5% of the issued share capital. This was moved up to 5%, but it's still not a very good deal.
Yeah, but it's 5% of something. Yeah. Better than 5% of nothing.
So the main theories are either they hold some of the debt, which they can try and recoup some of their costs.
But we don't know that for sure.
Can't verify that. There were some rumours, supposedly Coltrane put out there that they were going to try and see some of the directors, but I would doubt that any of the directors, even combined, have enough money to recoup the losses. It's kind of, it's a shallow well. The other theory is that just from a game theory perspective, it's a game of chicken, and it wasn't the payoff from giving in was not big enough to justify being seen to give in, essentially.
Yeah, this was something you suggested to me when we spoke about this yesterday. It was kind of they've taken it on the chin.
Yeah.
Because rather than fight this and kind of lose political capital, as it were, in the future they can be a bit more hardline in their dealings with similar situations.
Absolutely, yeah. They live to fight another day, and they are shareholders in Capita, so they own 0.31% of Capita. So perhaps they're...
Well, Capita might be the bigger prize here for them.
Potentially, yeah, yeah. They also have I think it's a 2.5% short stake in Mighty. So they've clearly got some views on what way the sector is going.
Yeah. I know we spoke earlier, Phil, you're not a big fan of outsourcing.
These are bad businesses. No one on the outside really understands what's going on with these companies. There's so much scope for smoke and mirrors, financial shenanigans, contracts, cash flows are all over the place. And for many of these companies, not all, but for many of these companies to be loaded up with debt, both on and off balance sheet, because you've got to look at some of these companies are involved in PFI and there is a huge amount of debt that is off balance sheet in these companies, is just complete madness as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I mean, we've spoken about this, maybe even on this podcast, but just there's something fundamentally odd about a model where you, as a an organisation, say a local government wanting to save some money, will give a contract to an outsourcer who can make money from something that costs you less.
Yeah,
I've never quite understood that.
I don't get it either. I mean, it's clear that looking at this from a business point of view, there are things like savings on employer national insurance, pension payments, that kind of thing.
But enough to.
It probably, if you look at it on certain projects, I can buy into it. But on sort of mass scale running of public services, whether these companies deliver value for the taxpayer, I'm deeply sceptical.
I mean, my theory has been that the only way that they could possibly make money is to degrade the service. That you actually don't get the same service when you outsource it as you would have done were it still run by whatever.
Not only that, the organisation or the company that's doing the outsourcing loses a degree of control of their business, in my opinion. They're not at the coalface. They lose certain amounts of knowledge about what's going on within their business by giving it to a third party. And
Railtrek is a big example you often cite to me, because you were there when that whole thing kicked off.
I was, yeah.
Tell us about it. It's a really fascinating story.
Well, yeah, I mean, Railtrack is a classic example of outsourcing the repairs and maintenance of the tracks and the overhead wires and the railway network. And companies like Carillion, Balfour Beatty, the outsourcing companies, were once upon a time making reasonably fat margins, sort of 5-6% of doing all the maintenance work of the tracks and the stations and the bridges and so on. And one of the things that really signed the death warrant of Railtrack as a public company was, firstly, it was under pressure to make cost savings on maintenance, and it was paying fat margins to contractors. But more important than that, it didn't really understand the condition of its asset base. This is what really, really nobbled Railtrack, in that every time it came to look at its assets, they were in a worse condition than they thought they would be, which is surprising, really, given you paid somebody to look after them.
Yeah, and it didn't end. I mean, it ended in tragedy.
It ended in tragedy, yeah, for lots of different reasons.
Financial tragedy, but actually, some people lost their lives as a result of
this. Yes, yeah, but from the financial point of view, not trying to sort of get away from the tragedy side of it. The company wasn't in control. And I'm not saying that was all down to outsourcing. A lot of it was done for bad contract decisions on things like the West Coast Main Line upgrade and the Thames Link upgrade. But certainly in terms of knowledge about how their business was being run and the conditions of the rail network, I'm pretty much convinced that the choice to outsource the maintenance of that, the day-to-day maintenance of that, to third parties was a big reason why they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And hence, every time the regulators gave them an amount of money to spend, they would come back and say, oh, no, our assets are a lot worse than we think. We need more money. And eventually you got to the situation where the government just said, I've had enough of this.
Yeah.
So we've been paying for it for the last 20 years.
Absolutely, yeah. My commute's not cheap. Let's come back to you, Tom. So outsourcing as a model, we're not fans. No. And we're not fans as investors either, really the conclusion of your piece there. And you've obviously written on Capita as well this week. I mean, there has been, looking at that share price graph, a little bit of optimism recently. But you're still not convinced?
I think basically the lack of trust from more or less all of the outsourcers gives me a very high barrier that they need to cross to prove that they are kind of doing well again.
What are they trying to do? I mean, you, in your conclusion to your results write-up, they're trying to basically shift or change the nature of the contracts that they're delivering.
Yeah.
To improve the quality of those contracts, get out of the lower margin stuff.
Yeah.
And you're not convinced that's happening quickly enough.
No. So basically what you'll see with a lot of the outsourcers is where they're trying to move away from this perception of them as the low margin, we do everything outsourcing. So they'll now talk about their specialties. With Mighty, they've been talking more about security. With Capita, they've been talking more and more about technology. The problem is the actual tech-focused parts of the business are pretty small compared to the business at large.
Mm.
And it's just for them to actually go kind of full tech company, for them to turn into Experian, for example, it's just a big jump from where they are now to where they need to be. And they've been doing really well selling off parts of the business, cutting down costs. It's just a question of how much is left once you've cut out all the bad bits to kind of become this swanky new company that's going to disrupt the old company.
And where the new contracts are going to come from.
Well,
because
exactly.
Presumably there are other companies going after those contracts too.
Yeah, it's very easy to say you'll get like technology will be our future, but very few people can actually explain what that means in practice.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So we're not big fans of the outsourcing sector. Have you got any of them on a buy? Babcock?
No, Babcock, we moved to a hold. Babcock has actually reclassified themselves as aerospace and defence.
Have they?
Largely in response to this, I'd imagine.
That old chestnut. People don't like outsourcing, I'll shift sector.
Serco is doing okay, though I'm a long way off saying to buy them. I think Mears is doing all right, but they're very housing focused. You basically need something that you can demonstrably hang your hat on. What is it you do, not just outsource?
I mean, there is something to be said for the fact that, you know, whenever you hire someone to provide a service, you're outsourcing something of your business.
Yeah.
I guess it's just the scale of what you're outsourcing, how much of what you outsource.
I mean, you could just, if you were really big on kind.
Go on, Phil.
You could just say, these companies are like glorified gangmasters.
Oh.
Just providing pools of labour at the low end of the market. They are a steward of labour.
Well, G4S, I think, I used to cover that sector as well. G4S, if I remember rightly, was the largest employer on the FTSE 100 because of exactly what you say, Phil.
Right.
Just, I mean, armies of security guards, that's what it did.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is what's the value add here? What's the value add proposition from the outsourcer to the end customer? And you know, I'm not trying to cast aspersions that they're doing anything wrong, but I just, you know, as an investor, I just want to know what is the USP of this that creates a sustainable, growing, high quality revenue and profit stream? Because I can't see it.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. So that's the verdict on outsourcers. Avoid.
Yes.
Is there anything that's caught your eye that you've covered this week, Tom, that, you know, on a more positive note?
It's,
you don't have to say yes.
It's been an absolute deluge this week with the results season. I was trying to think.
Safe Charge, you've got on a buy. That's an interesting little company.
Yes. Yeah, that was... I was covering that on behalf of my colleague Harriet Clarfeld. But yeah, payments is generally quite an exciting area, isn't it? They've been growing extremely quickly. I was talking to them on the day, and they've got obviously massive growth story. The revenues were $139 million in a year, but supposedly the size of the market is $3 to $4 trillion. So,
well, payments is huge, and we've seen the lead story obviously this week is Worldpay, which is again in the target the crosshairs of an acquisition. We spoke last week about MasterCard. Payments is a really interesting area, you know, you can see the end of cash, as we talked about last week, coming down the road.
And
so.
these are very profitable businesses.
Yeah.
You know, SafeCharge is a pretty profitable business.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, there's money in this sector.
There's gold in these hills.
Well, I won't go as far as that, but you can see why people are having a look at this.
Well, it plays into all of the big trends, e-commerce and, you know, mobile devices.
Yeah.
It's a confluence of a lot of these big trends.
But in terms of this sector, you know, it's not been a bad place for investors to fish in.
No, especially if you bought Worldpay.
Yeah.
Two takeovers in 6 months. It's nice, isn't it?
I think I saw a very interesting stat, actually, about Worldpay, how it... Obviously, it used to be owned by
RBS,
and it became bigger than the market cap of RBS, which obviously is not difficult given what happened to it, but just shows that RBS got rid of this. And
RBS was forced to get rid of it, wasn't it, really?
Well, fair enough. But
that's what happens when you run your business badly, you get in trouble,
exactly.
And have to sell off your best bits.
Exactly. So they sold off the one of something that's turned out to be a gem.
Yeah, absolutely. What have you been looking at in your Alpha report this week, Phil? What's caught your eye? Well, lots of results. No, I mean, there's no shortage of things to catch your eye.
One of the things, actually, I think is one of the most interesting developments of the week is JD Sports buying Foot Asylum.
Foot Asylum, which we've had on a sell for ages, and rightly so.
Well, it doesn't make any money,
and it can't get the right stock, and it's a pretty bad idea. Yeah. Now we've been slightly caught out by the most recent turn of events, but you kind of think this is a good deal for JD.
I think this is a good deal for JD. Yeah, I like JD Sports as a business. I think it has got a real stranglehold on its market.
I just know it. I've got children that buy trainers.
Yeah, and it's been tremendous. It's been doing a great job, obviously, for its customers and for its shareholders. I'm a little bit concerned when it bought Finish Line in America last year. I'm still not convinced about that deal, given how cutthroat the market for trainers and athleisure is out in America.
But I guess the rationale there was that, because JD has such good relations with the likes of Nike and Adidas, and that actually, you know, the usual problems that befall British companies trying to get to America don't necessarily apply.
There is that, but there's also the trend of Nike selling direct to consumers in that market.
Do people really buy trainers direct? Dom, do people buy trainers direct?
I don't.
No.
But Amazon's a big player out there as well.
Yeah.
Much more so than they are here. But I think what the deal does do is it gives JD a lot of buying power. This is what I think.
This is the Finish Line deal rather than the
Finish Line deal. Yeah, but it's got a reasonable amount of buying power without Finishing Line. Finish Line. But Finish Line gives it even more.
Mm.
And this is why this Foot Asylum deal stacks up quite nicely, actually, because Foot Asylum's got 220, 225 million of sales and it's not making any money on it. Put JD Sports buying power into this business and you can probably get it making 15, perhaps 20 million pounds in the next year, 18 months.
I presume it didn't pay very much for this.
If you look at the overall in price, it valued the business at about 90 million. But JD had been buying stakes before then, so JD's in price is going to be less than 90 million. So if they can make 15 million, 20 million of that, that's a good return on investment.
Mm. And so it's just quick expansion, really, then.
Yeah, it's a good tuck-in deal. It's not going to transform JD, but I think this is a really smart deal from a very smart operator.
Yeah, it's a funny kind of sort of links that there are between these two companies. I mean, I can never get my head around exactly who is related to who here and who set up what and whose grandfather is so and so. But there are links here.
Yeah,
they must have had their eye on this for a while. They knew this was coming.
Yeah, I don't think people see this as a massive surprise. But from a financial point of view, from a business point of view, I think it ticks a lot of boxes.
We've always liked JD Sports. It's always been very cheap, the shares in JD Sports, I think.
You know, they're still now, just over 15 times next year's earnings.
It's not that bad.
For a company that's doing pretty well, growing, quite decent margins. I mean, not super high margin, I think 9-10% margins. Good cash generator, dominant position in the market. Well, a lot to be said for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a perma-buy on the IC, I have to say.
Well, okay.
I like a perma-bear.
Yeah, I think JD was one that stood up. The other interesting one was, which was the back end of last week, was Cineworld.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot of myths that get sort of peddled around about cinemas. I think there's a sort of general sort of layperson's view that the likes of Netflix and Amazon and Now TV are going to kill cinemas. And that's not happening. Actually, cinema attendance, not for Cineworld in the UK, but actually UK cinema attendance is buoyant.
aren't they? They're very much reliant on there being a good slate of films coming
out. Yeah, that's out of their control.
So there is a bit of their business that, yeah, as you say, they don't have control over. I haven't been to the cinema for a long time. And I used to go a lot. Do you go to the cinema much, Tom?
Yeah, in recent years, I've noticed that they've moved away from the kind of big box Odeon type thing. You see more and more in London. You have Picture House, which is like, it's quite trendy. They have craft beer and it's quite fancy.
He's going for the beer then, aren't
you? Every man as well.
Every man, yeah. So there's an Every Man.
Are they Cineworld?
You
mean the higher end cinema experience.
Yeah, it's sell you burgers and pizza, and while you're watching the film, you sit on the
sofa. Yeah, and they bring out some milkshakes for you. Yeah, I have been to them once. It's very nice.
Beats the Odeon. It certainly beats sort of watching it on Netflix, doesn't it? So it's kind of more of an experience. It's like music, isn't it?
It's
like
quite pricey though, isn't it?
Yeah,
and you got family of four of you going to the cinema. It adds up to quite a lot of money, but not so much in my view that it isn't an affordable treat. And Cineworld is doing okay.
Is it doing okay? I mean, it was when we first started looking at this business, which was, I don't know, when did it come to market? But we certainly, again, it was one that we repeatedly bought from about 2009-10 onwards.
Yeah,
and it was a UK business.
Yeah,
it's not anymore.
No, and that's where it starts to get a bit more messy, because it has paid a hell of a lot of money to buy Regal Entertainment in America. And essentially now the fortunes of this business are essentially an all-in wager on the American cinema market.
I know nothing about the American cinema market. This is where it gets difficult.
What I would say, though, is that it's the American cinema market. If you look at things like admissions, pricing, it's doing better for Cineworld than the UK is. And if you look at the sort of, just give you a feel on the scale of the business, there's about just over 300 million admissions to the cinemas last year, and about just over 50 million of them in the UK. Mm. So most of it is coming from America.
It's got a big Eastern European business as well, hasn't it?
Not massive, but it's...
But that was the first big deal that did outside of the UK.
But in terms of the scale of it now, it's pretty much about America. The trouble is they've paid a huge price for this. They're getting a very low rate of return on investment, and they are carrying a lot of debt. And these businesses are, there's a reasonable amount of fixed cost in these businesses. And you've also got a lot of financial cost in there as well. So you've got, in the sort of financial jargon, you've got operational gearing. So you've got sensitivity of operating profits to changes in revenues, and you've got financial gearing. That's fine as long as the top line, the revenue line, is growing.
Are you in the same sort of territory as you are with pumps? In terms of the repair and maintenance, for example, as you get these higher end operators emerging, you've got to keep your offering up to scratch.
Definitely. And I think, if you look at the way that you've got Disney launching an online stream, and the fear for these businesses is that the filmmakers, these companies aren't in control of their content. It's the film companies that control the content.
Having said that, they do sort of interesting deals with sort of non-cinema, non-film content. So, things like sort of live streaming theatres, productions or sports matches or whatever.
And will the sort of big blockbuster movies, will that move away from the cinemas to home streaming? Plug it into your 65-inch telly and your Dolby sound system.
Mm.
I think we're away from that, but clearly that's the risk. So this company has got, it's created. It probably felt it had to do this. If it didn't do this, where would it be?
Mm.
But it's paid a very high price for doing so. It's got it's a lot of debt. So there's quite a lot of risk here. But actually holding up quite well.
Yeah. We got it.
I'm not sure it's a share that I would buy.
Yeah. But there are certain metrics that look pretty decent.
There's decent yield on this.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. We've got it on a buy in the magazine.
Yeah.
And I guess you're not saying don't buy, but be circumspect.
I think they've arguably overpaid for Regal. And I think the business carries a lot more risk than it used to. But if they can do okay with it, they can keep generating the cash, paying down the debt. I think you've got a yield of about 4.5% on this.
Mm.
It's not a dog.
Yeah, no, it's a good business. We've always liked it. Thank you, Phil, and thank you, Tom. Let me quickly just talk you all through what else we've got in the magazine. You covered a few other companies in your Alpha update this week, Phil. What have you got in there? Ricardo Restaurant Group. We've talked about those quite a lot on this podcast. The baffling Ricardo.
Judges Scientific,
which got results for as well.
I've looked at it as well, yeah.
Interesting little company.
Yeah.
We have the Tech Focus looking at the future of transportation, talking about our season tickets earlier. This is where the train operators go from here, because it's not a nice market to be in. Algae, looking at an old Shaughnessy growth screen. On the features, James Norrington's cover feature, How to Win at Brexit. Looking at a strategy for whatever happens in Parliament this week, or whatever doesn't happen in Parliament this week, who knows? But James has really looked at some of the, in particular, the risk premium around this and actually how you can actually play this political situation to your advantage. Alex Janoir has done the secondary feature, which is something very, very much a departure for this magazine, looking at Islamic finance. Actually plays, surprisingly, from my perspective, into the environmental, social and governance theme, which I know you love so much, Phil. but it's really, really interesting. And we've actually run one of Bearball's portfolios through some of the screening criteria that Sharia finance requires. It's really, really fascinating. And yeah, lots and lots of results, lots in the comments section, including Paul Jackson looking at GVC.
That was a great column.
It is a great column. Yeah. I do like his evisceration management greed.
My pick of the week.
It is a great column.
Yeah.
And yeah, lots of the news section as well. We've talked through Inserve. We've talked through JD Sports. We haven't talked about ASOS. My kids always tell me off for pronouncing that incorrectly, which has had a kind of interesting week. And Inmarsat, which has a bit of interest there in the satellite operator. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you again, Tom. Thank you, Phil. And pick up the magazine, All Good News Agents, How to Win at Brexit, Make the Battle to Leave the EU Stack Up for Your Portfolio. It's one of my favourite covers of the year so far. Anyway, see you all next week. Thank you.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.